Welcome to The Hidden Gin, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey.
Before we begin this week, a gentle word of warning. There are references to sexual assault in this episode, so please proceed with care. Decades ago, I knew a family that lived in my mother's town that had three young daughters. The lady of the house was a close friend of my mother's, and so in other words, she was kind of an auntie to us, and every so often auntie would drop by for a visit, bringing boxes of homemade sweets, or a platter of rice, or some little treat to share over a cup of hot chai. And oftentimes, one of her daughters would come with her. The eldest was maybe around 20, and the youngest was an early teen. For years, though, I never met the third daughter, the middle one. Once in a while, Auntie would mention her name. She would ask my mother for prayers, say something in passing about her doing better or worse. One day after she left, my mother sat shaking her head, looking deeply sad about whatever Auntie had shared with her, and I asked, "What's wrong?" My mother took a deep sigh and responded, "She thinks her daughter has a jinn." That's when I finally learned that the third daughter, the one I never saw, had an entire host of what her parents understood to be symptoms of either the evil eye or jinn possession or a combination of the two. But my mother explained to me, it was just as possible that the daughter had mental health or medical issues. If she did, though, Auntie wasn't prepared to accept it and seek professional advice. Instead, she sought help elsewhere, soliciting prayers and charms from spiritual healers, hoping something would drive away the demons that caused the young girl to lash out, that kept her tongue-tied and frustrated, that kept her afflicted, suffering, and isolated from the rest of the world. But nothing worked. My mother tried to counsel her to take the girl to see a doctor or a psychologist or even a psychiatrist, but the advice didn't land. Auntie was convinced that someone had put a curse on her daughter, a curse for a jinn to torment her. At some point, maybe a few years after I first got to know Auntie, I finally met that third daughter. She was sweet and kind, shy and mostly quiet, but though when she did speak, her words were halting and repetitive. I didn't get a sense that she was haunted or tormented by anything. But one thing was painfully clear to me and to anyone else who might be familiar with the condition. The young woman was autistic. So what happens when developmental or mental health issues, physical disabilities, disease, chronic illness, emotional dysregulation, or any one of hundreds of physiological and psychological conditions that human beings experience is understood through the lens of the supernatural? How do you know whether you're suffering from a treatable condition or you've been struck by a jinn? Is the affliction in the psyche or in the soul? Well, the lines have been blurred throughout history, and today we'll explore what it looks like over the centuries when medicine, psychology, and the supernatural cross paths. I'm Rabia Chaudhry, and I'll be your guide into the ancient world of the hidden jinn. Welcome.
Stars are the celestial doubles of human beings. Jinn familiars are their underground doubles, and the leaves of the trees of paradise are their doubles in paradise. When human beings are sick, the jinn double is sick with the same sickness. His star pales, and the leaf of the tree of paradise yellows and curls. At the hour of death, the jinn dies first. The star falls from the sky as a shooting star, and the leaf detaches from the tree of paradise.
That is from a 1926 collection of cosmology collected in Marrakesh, Morocco, that documented, among other things, the belief that the human condition exists in several planes at once, and whatever it goes through, whatever it experiences, is experienced by corresponding entities linked intimately to each of us. For every person, a leaf on the tree of paradise, a star in the heavens, and a jinn in the underworld. The jinn will live, get sick, and die with us. But what about the jinn who actually make us sick? According to a book titled The Jinn and Human Sickness, an entire host of conditions can and are attributed to jinn, including depression, anxiety, epilepsy, personality disorders, psychiatric breaks with reality. Now, the movements of the jinn in and upon the human body can't really be tracked because the jinn are created out of smokeless fire, an energy that cannot be contained. They're able to move with our bloodstream itself. They say there are two ways in which jinn physically afflict human beings. They can either strike a person or possess a person. Striking a person could mean sudden paralysis or blindness or any other physical condition that just appears out of nowhere. Or even a more literal strike, like suddenly you lost all your hearing in one ear. Maybe it was because a jinn slapped you on that side of the head. But you must be asking yourself, why would any jinn be bothered enough to strike a person? More often than not, it's because the jinn was offended or disrespected, knowingly or unknowingly. Urinating in the wrong spot, let's say in a shadowy corner a jinn called home, could incur its wrath. Or wearing the wrong color in the wrong place at the wrong time might anger a jinn. And you might really peeve one off if you disrespect it by rejecting the existence of jinn altogether. Sometimes, though, the affliction is actually a way to connect a jinn to a person, a means of establishing first contact, you could say. And shaking that contact isn't always easy. But for thousands of years, there have been healers and magicians to help take care of such bothersome attachments. It seems that the idea that illness stems from and therefore requires spiritual or supernatural interventions is as old as history itself. Unto the side of the wanderer have drawn nigh, casting a woeful fever upon his body. A bane of evil had settled on his body, an evil disease on his body they have cast, an evil plague had settled on his body, evil venom on his body they have cast, an evil curse had settled on his body, evil and sin on his body they have cast, venom and wickedness have settled upon him. This priestly Assyrian chant is thousands of years old, a litany of the many ways evil spirits attacked some poor soul. And the doctors of ancient times were, in fact, the healers and the magicians and the priests, sometimes indistinguishable between any of them. They were the ones who were called upon to help heal the sick, with little space between medicine, religion, and magic. These healer magicians were regarded by society as honored warriors, waging war against unseen forces on the battlefield of the human body. They wielded an array of tools, each instrument specialized to deal with whatever demon was causing the sickness, and also used chants, spells, and rituals to drive away the forces of illness. But how did they know which demon it was and what tools to use? Well, it was pretty simple. It all depended on which part of the body was ailing. The symptoms of whatever ailment a person was struck with themselves gave rise to the diagnosis. For example, a painful throat pointed to Utuku, the demon jinn who, well, lived to attack human throats. Fevers, you're dealing with Asaku. Skin disease, the demon Rubisu was the culprit. The ancient Greeks likewise believed both that evil spirits could cause every matter of sickness, but also that there were gods you could turn to for healing, so it kind of balanced it out. And sometimes the evil spirits themselves began to be worshipped as gods as a way to appease them, through rituals of praise and even blood sacrifice. For example, there's the demigod Al-Muharrik. He was a fierce, angry, and ancient pre-Islamic god that was worshipped in parts of the Middle East. His name means the one who burns, and he lords over a crimson throne red as flames. Al-Muharrik was known to be a god of the underworld, and much like his Babylonian counterpart, the god Nergal, he was a deity of disease. But Al-Muharrik didn't just attack one person. His wrath was more efficient, you could say. Al-Muharrik sent plagues to sicken entire regions, and later his legend morphed into him being the jinn of plagues and pestilence. According to Ottoman mystics, the jinn afflicted humans with the plague and other epidemics by piercing them with the tip of a disease-ridden spear or arrow. Treatises written in the 15th and 16th century also share that sometimes these plagues are spread by the direct command of Satan himself, who directs his legions of jinn to go rampaging against hapless humans. But according to the same treatises, there is a way to protect yourself. If the plague is a war on man sent by Satan, man can fight back by invoking a powerful name of God against the disease. A famous Turkish historian scholar by the name of Tasko Pruzadi prescribed the following for protection against the plague-carrying jinn. Repeat Al-Baki, a name of God that means the everlasting, 136 times a day, and no such jinn could touch you. Tasko Pruzadi wrote about a story in which a group of students living in Kashgar, a city on the Silk Road bordering Afghanistan, saw frightening shadows on a wall. The shadows were of figures carrying arrows. But what was more frightening was that there was nothing in the room to actually cast the shadows, which could only mean one thing. The figures were jinn. And the tips of the arrows they carried were poisoned with plague. The students were told to write down the powerful names of God on pieces of paper as a talisman to protect themselves. According to the story, those who followed instructions were saved, and those who didn't perished. Hundreds of similar prayerful invocations are prescribed throughout Islamic plague treatises from that time, and likewise, Christian and Jewish writings reflect the same ideas and even language. Take, for example, Psalm 91, a prayer that reads, "You who live in the shelter of the Most High, who abide in the shadow of the Almighty, will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. For he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and buckler. You will not fear the terror of night, or the arrow that flies by day, or the pestilence that stalks in darkness, or the destruction that wastes at noonday." While Muslims, Christians, and Jews have always had much in common to discuss in interfaith gatherings, having a shared belief in dark evil forces that shoot arrows of disease probably comes as a surprise to many of us. On the subject of physical ailments, if there's ever a convenient time to blame a jinn, it's when the issue is, well, a deeply personal one. In 2018, a medical journal published a piece by a doctor from the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the Healthcare Medical Center in Dubai, entitled, quote, "Infertility Caused by Jinn." This same doctor, Dr. Mira Bajirova, had previously written an article for the Archives of Sexual Reproduction and Health titled, quote, "Infertility Caused by Decreased Oxygen Utilization and Jinn." Now, I was as surprised as you to find such pieces in recent medical journals, but such is the power of spiritual belief. Now, the thesis of these pieces is that evil jinn take no greater pleasure than they do in wrecking marriages through all kinds of means, like causing enmity between spouses over finances, disputes over family issues, lessening their attraction for each other, or just making them irritable and hateful to each other. But if none of that works, they can take more direct action too, like causing sexual disorders, miscarriages, impotence, premature ejaculation, early menopause, and yes, infertility. Sometimes the jinn might do it on their own, but more often than not, they cause these problems because someone, a rival or enemy, has summoned them with black magic to destroy the happy life of a couple that they want to harm. The articles come complete with very official-looking charts and list dozens of sexual and reproductive disorders that might be inflicted by the jinn, or could be actual symptoms of being possessed by one. And there are a number of very interesting cases presented in these pieces, like the one in which a patient suffering from polycystic ovaries failed to follow the doctor's instructions and then disappeared for a couple of years. She then returned to the doctor after a frightening experience. She was standing in front of a mirror one night applying lipstick when suddenly a bright red patch appeared on her clothing, below her pelvis. She was bleeding, heavily, and it wasn't clear whether it was menstrual blood or not. Whatever it was, it shocked her into returning for medical treatment. The case summary in the article concludes, and I quote, "Mirror attracts the jinn is circulating in the body, settles in the womb, and opens the uterine vessels, causing abnormal bleeding." The doctor also had a theory behind male impotence and other sexual dysfunction. This happens apparently when a female jinn, well, the doctor conceded that maybe a male jinn too, was sexually attracted to a human male and messed with his system so he could neither find satisfaction or give satisfaction to another human partner. Talk about being possessive. Anyhow, if that caught your ear, don't worry. We'll be getting into the phenomena of human-jinn relationships in a later episode. But spoiler alert, the relationships aren't always voluntary. Getting back to the connection between evil forces and sexual and reproductive issues, we have to keep this in mind. One effective way to lessen the stigma of these conditions and lessen the personal blame some might ascribe themselves may be to find an external cause. When it's black magic, the evil eye, or a wicked jinn, it affords a bit of protection to those who might otherwise be mistreated by their partners or families or society for failing to fulfill their obligation to go forth and multiply. It's ironic, actually, that such proscriptions might just be a compassionate way of letting people off the hook, including medical and health professionals. All faults and deficiencies get attributed to the jinn, freeing people of accountability, blame, and shame. At the same time, though, it also keeps alive a thriving source of income for the people and institutions who claim to be able to heal the things that science cannot. And it opens the doors for criminals and predators who prey on the vulnerable. A 2012 article in the Pakistani newspaper Dawn reported the arrest of a faith healer promising to free a young girl of jinn. But instead, the girl's mother caught the man in the act of raping her daughter. Thankfully, he was arrested, but catching such culprits isn't always so cut and dry. In South Asia, and maybe it happens in other parts of the world, but at least I can personally vouch for this region, while there are doctors and clinics, of course, that can treat infertility, what happens when a wife, unable to produce any children, gets repeatedly checked out and the medical professionals say she's just fine? Well, thanks to misogyny and the patriarchy getting in the way of good judgment, oftentimes no one thinks to check the husband's reproductive health because, well, that would be unthinkable. So the only remaining explanation then is supernatural. A curse that woman is suffering from, or maybe a jinn. And so there have been countless stories of women, once humiliated for being barren and unable to conceive, miraculously becoming pregnant after being left alone for treatment with some fraudulent holy man who claimed that he could drive out the jinn preventing conception. Imagine then the situation these women face. Finally pregnant to the great joy of their families, but not through some mysterious spiritual healing. Instead, because they're the victims of sexual assault by these fake religious healers. These women are left to hold this terrible secret, a secret they undoubtedly share with dozens of other victims. The secret that more often than not, you don't have to fear the supernatural, because the worst monsters are usually human. A 2005 article in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine presented the case of a 25-year-old Iraqi woman living in the UK with no history of any psychological or psychiatric disorders, who began to slowly but surely withdraw from life. Over time, she stopped being in the company of other people, stopped communicating, and eventually even stopped eating. Doctors diagnosed her with severe depression and subjected her to electroshock therapy, which did nothing for the patient, but further confirmed her family's suspicion that they were dealing with something else here. They secretly believed that their daughter was under the influence or possessed by a jinn. Without telling the medical professionals involved, they ferried the young woman off to see a faith healer, who assured them that he could cure her with prayer and ritual. After all, faith is often the last resort of the desperate. The healer put his patient through a few sessions of spiritual therapy, and miraculously, her appetite returned, as did her previous emotional health. She reported that she wasn't sure what had happened to her, that she was fully aware of her condition, but she just couldn't bring herself to do anything to come out of it, even though, of her own admission, she wasn't particularly feeling sad or depressed about anything at all. According to the article, even 5 years later, she was still doing fine without any medications or any other treatment since the spiritual healing. But of course, not all such stories have happy endings. For some, the spiritual healing itself becomes a private hell. People have long both feared madness and been in awe of it. The ancient Greeks thought some madness to be sacred, opening divine portals and the power of prophecy. And then there's the dark side of madness, the one that's not caused by gods or saints, but by demons. Or sometimes by something in between, like Lyssa, known to the Greeks as both the goddess and demon of rage and frenzy. In the Greek tragedy, The Madness of Heracles, Heracles, the son of Zeus, stands before his father's altar, ready to purify himself, when suddenly, Lyssa strikes him with madness. Heracles spun around, his eyes rolling in his head, mouth foaming, and mounted an imaginary chariot. He bellowed maniacal laughter as he drew his bow and took aim at his own children. He didn't know they were his children, though. In his madness, he believed they were the children of an enemy. Heracles' terrified children tried to save themselves. One child hid behind his mother, another behind a temple pillar, and the third one under an altar. But it didn't deter Heracles. He killed all three of his children and his own wife before finally being struck by a rock that put him in a deep slumber. Greek mythology is full of madness caused by demons or curses, leading to murder, suicide, infanticide, and other unthinkable acts. Such evil, you see, can madness be. And the line between madness and evil forces is just as straight in the Arabian tradition, both predating and after the 7th century when Islam emerged as a religion in the region. A mad person is called majnu, and madness itself is called janun. Both of these words have the same three-letter origin as jinn, those letters in the English alphabet being J and N. Majnu, janun, jinn. They're not only related, majnun literally means possessed by a jinn, whether or not that person is actually possessed. So how do the jinn drive a person mad? Well, they have a few tricks up their sleeves. First is the insidious waswasa, the whisperings. Am I good enough? Am I pretty enough? Is my husband cheating on me? Are my friends talking about me? Did my brother steal from me? Is that woman following me? Are my children safe? Will my parents die? Those doubts and negative thoughts that you can't get rid of, that continuous, persistent stream of anxious questions and insecurities that circulates in your mind constantly, it may well be a jinn whispering to you, in your very own voice. Maybe it's even your Kareen, that constant companion jinn that's born with you and for you and dies with you too. The jinn know that if they're at it long enough, it can lead people, if not to sheer madness, then to depression, panic attacks, resentment and anger, and even suicidal ideation. And if that doesn't work, they'll try to drive you mad with their music. It's not really music though, it's more of a sound, not unlike a siren song, but a bit more creative. It can sound like a constant buzzing of flies or bees, or the incessant chirp of a bird. It could be the sound of wind, or a far-off wail, or never-ending murmurs, or maybe the faint beating of drums for hours and days, both when you wake and sleep. It could just be a sound repeated over and over, like it was reported by an ancient poet who described it as zizizima, zizima, zizizima. Before the advent of modern psychiatry and psychology, this was all understood to be symptoms of external malevolent forces. But even in the modern era, it can be hard for many to draw lines between the natural and the supernatural, to know when to take a loved one to a psychiatrist and when to take them to a spiritual healer. And in some places, there are almost no options but to choose the latter. In the small town of Bouya Oumar, in the heart of Morocco, there stands a mausoleum dedicated to a 16th century saint the town itself was named after. This particular saint was known to cure those suffering from what we today understand to be psychiatric disorders. But before modern medicine was generally considered madness caused by jinn. And this mausoleum, a shrine for that saint, became a place of hope for the loved ones of those who were thought to be touched by madness, but a place of despair for the afflicted themselves. Families came from near and far to leave their sick children, siblings, elders at the shrine in the hopes that the healers working there and the power of the shrine itself would cure their loved ones. Whether the families were driven by love or fear, guilt or faith, their patronage brought a steady stream of revenue to the shrine, which charged a monthly housing fee for their patients and made nearly $1 million a year from their services. The healers there claimed they could heal through their own power, derived from the deceased saint himself, that they had power over the jinn that were either afflicting the patients or by employing the jinn that were already in their control to battle the ones that were not in their control. People passing by would hear howling and screams, sobs and cries for mercy, all which was chalked up to the torment of the jinn who were being exorcised from their victims. Except that's probably not what it was. Not too many years ago, reports began emerging of the torture these patients, treated more like animals, faced. Human rights activists raised allegations that patients at the shrine were often shackled and beaten, even starved, and that place must be shut down. So serious and systematic was the situation that a report was even presented to the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention. One story detailed the horror faced by a young man from Tangiers who had a drug addiction and had been left at Buya Umar in 2006 by his brother. He was robbed and beaten, deprived of food and water, but was finally saved by the same brother who came to see him a year later. For a year, he said, he lived in hell. As these tales emerged, medical professionals and human rights groups demanded that the government shut the shrine down, putting the authorities between a rock and a hard place. After all, the shrine was part and parcel of their cultural heritage, as were the beliefs around jinn and spiritual healing. Others counter-protested, insisting the shrine remain open, not only because of its historic importance, but also because they simply didn't know what to do with their loved ones, where to take them, how to help heal them. But the government conducted a review of the shrine operations and in 2015 shut it down, much to the relief of activists and health professionals. It didn't just shut down the shrine, though. The government allocated millions of dollars for the patients that would be escaping the shrine, recruited mental health professionals, and bought dozens of ambulances to transport the ill. And the story itself prompted both national and international conversations about mental health, abuse of power, human rights, tradition, and faith, but also about jinn. After all, the government could shut down the shrine, but they couldn't shut down the healers who claimed powers derived from the saint. And they couldn't shut down the jinn themselves. Because as long as there are jinn, there will always be people who promise they can save you from them. They say there's sometimes a fine line between a gift and a curse, and such is the case with madness too. Because while it has often been thought to be a result of evil or dark forces, there is a place on the spectrum that has long been considered a portal to enlightenment. In the Sufi tradition, you were lucky to be known as majthub, meaning an unruly friend of God, a person touched with madness that connected them to the divine, opened them up to secrets, gave them the ability to see and understand and know things the rest of us aren't capable of. These people would be forgiven in an otherwise orthodox society for exhibiting bizarre behavior and speech, like running around naked, babbling in tongues, dancing in frenetic ecstasy, and breaking all kinds of religious and social norms. And yes, this sacred madness was attributed to jinn. Good jinn, that is. Pious jinn who possessed the bodies of pious men and women and opened up the reality of God to them, connecting them through the madness to an unseen holy realm. The awe that these unruly friends inspired in Sufis may seem odd, but then behold the Western regard for genius. The German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer once said, "Genius lives only one story above madness." And well before that, Aristotle told us, no great mind has ever existed without a touch of madness. Indeed, many of the celebrated geniuses of Western art, literature, science, and philosophy suffered from some psychiatric or psychological disorder. Many, many studies have been done correlating the two phenomena and making a strong case for the relationship between madness and art. One study found that 87% of famous poets experienced psychopathology, and another study found, quote, a very high percentage of the writers and artists, 38%, had been treated for a mood disorder. Of those treated, 3/4 had been given antidepressants, lithium, or had been hospitalized. There are researchers who dismiss the idea that madness and genius are correlated, citing poorly designed studies and conflation and an entire host of undermining factors. But then, the famous Lord Byron once said about himself, "We of the craft are all crazy. Some are affected by gaiety, others by melancholy, but all are more or less touched." Byron spoke from personal experience. Both he and his contemporary, Percy Shelley, were afflicted with wide-ranging mood swings, from deep sadness and apathy to fits of uncontrollable rage, common signs of manic depressive disorder. Van Gogh suffered mental illness for many years of his life, leading him to both slice off his ear and shoot himself in the chest. Nikola Tesla, Nietzsche, Isaac Newton, Edgar Allan Poe, Virginia Woolf, Wolfgang Amadeus, the list of mad geniuses goes on and on. And just like the Sufis gave a pass to their unruly friends of God, so has the West not just tolerated but celebrated its own unruly creatives, understanding on some level that these two forces go hand in hand. What, however, does any of this have to do with jinn? Well, you'd be surprised to know the etymology of the word genius. In case you didn't make the connection from how the word sounds, some scholars say it may have its roots in the Aramaic word jinnia and the Arabic word jinn, which makes perfect sense when you learn that the entire concept of genius dates back to ancient Rome, because the Romans believed that we are all born with genius. Actually, to be more precise, they believed that we are all born with a genius that was originally thought to be a guiding spirit that each one of us was born with, a supernatural entity that's separate from us, but lives with us, inside of us, inspiring us. I don't know. Sounds kind of like a jinn to me. Thanks for joining us this week. Next week, we'll be back to take you another step into the world of the hidden jinn. Until then, remember, we are not alone. If you loved today's episode, I'm going to ask you a big favor. Please stop by iTunes and leave me a rating and a review, even if it's just one short sentence. Not only is that how other listeners discover the podcast, but it's also what keeps the podcast going. And for every 1,000 reviews that I get on iTunes, I'll release another Patreon episode absolutely free. That's right, we're on Patreon. So if you're a gin enthusiast, check out the companion Patreon series at patreon.com/hiddengin. Again, that's patreon.com/hiddengin. And remember, gin is spelled D-J-I-N-N. That's where you're going to find an amazing series of interviews between me, scholars, experts, artists, historians, and everyday laypeople who have had extraordinary experiences with jinn. And everybody can check out the first episode absolutely free. It's me and my husband sharing our jinn stories, and it was a lot of fun. And if you have any jinn stories, well, I'd love to hear from you. Email me at thehiddenjinn@gmail.com. Once again, it's thehiddenjinn, Jin with a D, @gmail.com, and you might just hear back from me, or you might hear your story on the show. And finally, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram with the handle The Hidden Jin. There you can tweet, post, Insta, DM me. I'd love to hear from all of you, and believe me, I read every single message.
The Hidden Jinn is a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild from Aaron Mankey. The podcast is written and hosted by Rabia Chaudhry and produced by Miranda Hawkins and Trevor Young, with executive producers Aaron Mankey, Alex Williams, and Matt Frederick. Music for the show was provided by Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. Our theme song was created by Patrick Cortez. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.